So I'm going to introduce in-host influenza, so we're all about in-host this week. However, there's going to be almost no immunity in my talk, so don't get your hopes up if you're waiting for that. So what I want to do is kind of set the stage for your knowledge of influenza, because a lot of you know a lot about the epidemiological side of influenza, but not so much about the kind of in-host side of influenza, so I want to get you up to speed on that. So basically, influenza in humans is mostly a disease that affects your upper respiratory tract, and mostly kind of like, they say the upper 16 generation, or upper 6th generation rather, so each division is one generation, so we're talking about 1, 2, 3, etc., so roughly upper 6th generation. And the important thing to note is actually that it will destroy most of your cells in that area, which is pretty amazing, but we'll come back to that later. Influenza will kill about, so it will affect about 5 to 15% of the population, and result in 3 to 5 million severe cases with 250,000 to 500,000 deaths every year. That's seasonal flu. Gets a lot worse if this is a new strain for us, and we'll talk a bit about that here. There are 4 genera of influenza, and if you're thinking of me as a physicist, you're like, oh, maybe your math's not so good because there's only 3 here. It is early, but I did mean it. The 4th one is the influenza D, which is also called the Togotovirus, and he's just kind of weird, so we're not going to talk about him at all. And in fact, I'm not even going to talk about B and C, and the reason for that is that C is very, very common. It's in fact the most common, but you don't get sick from it, so who cares? B, at least not symptomatically sick. B, it kills some old people. It's bad, but it won't kill you, so we'll move on. Influenza A is the one that kills the most people, and in fact kills the most people because it's where all the pandemics have come out of. So no surprise, influenza A is our biggest interest because that's the one that all the epidemics have come out of, and I'm missing here swine flu, although that was not very deadly, we'll agree. The strain identification, just because for your own purposes, if you decided to go out there and start doing in-host influenza, you'd need to be able to parse these kind of informations. And so if you see something like that, and it's this full statement here, and that's how you identify a strain, at least an influenza A strain. So this says it's an influenza A. It was isolated in Hong Kong. It's strain from lab number 1 in 1968, and it's of the H3N2 subtype. And we'll come back to subtypes in a second when I talk to you about the little segments of negatively stranded RNA that are packed into the virus. In your annual vaccine, there are 3 strains of influenza: influenza A H1N1, influenza A H3N2, and influenza B. And right now, as you can imagine, this year, when you receive your seasonal vaccine, this is the swine flu you'll be receiving. And before that, we had 2 strains of Brisbane in these 2 positions. And that guy was drug resistant to oseltamivir, and we'll come back to that later. And for those of you who don't know, oseltamivir is Tamiflu, same thing. Okay. The vaccine strain, the reason why you have to be revaccinated every year is because of a slow antigenic drift, meaning the virus mutates. So when you encounter it the next year, it's mutated enough that you don't have cross-protective immunity from your vaccine. So it's not like immunity wanes very rapidly, it's just that it's a different virus. And there's also antigenic shift, which is when one piece of virus combines with another piece of virus, and then you've got a whole new beast, and then that's what usually gives rise to pandemics. Here is the big beast. Slightly enlarged, so you can see it. These are all the segments, the 8 segments of the negative stranded RNA of the, and it's a segmented RNA, of the influenza virus. I'm not going to talk much about these at all, not about the nucleoprotein, not about the NS protein, the non-structural protein, but I am going to talk to you right now about HA and NA, which is the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, which form the surface of your little virus, the spikes. There's also, you'll notice, M2 on the spike. So M2 is a transmembrane protein, and that's going to be playing a role when the virus actually successfully infects a cell and puts out its RNA and exports it to the nucleus. The hemagglutinin plays a role in viral attachment, and the neuraminidase plays a role in virus detachment once the virus has been produced, budding up the cell so that it can break free and go infect another cell. Now, you'll notice, though, that this is actually physiologically correct representation of the flu virus, because we've got approximately 80% of spikes are hemagglutinin, approximately 17% of spike are neuraminidase, and you've got a few M2s, the 16 to 20 per virion, we're maybe a little low there. But most importantly, you see that the neuraminidase are actually clustered in specific parts. Andrea this afternoon will be talking to you about the soft balance, the nice balance you have to have between hemagglutinin, which attaches the virus to the cell, and the neuraminidase, which allows us to break free. There's obviously an optimization problem here, and that's what Andrea Sandel is going to talk to you about this afternoon. Here's the viral replication cycle. So here's a virus coming in. It bends in the membrane, gets absorbed. The RNA gets emptied into the nucleus. Now, this is the step that amantadine, one of the drugs, will block. And then it replicates, magic stuff, comes up to the top. Now, I'm pointing out there's a basal and apical side because influenza viruses only bud from the apical side. They never bud anywhere else. They only bud from the surface of the cell, and they have a whole bunch of magic tricks to do that. And then they actually go ahead and bud, and the most important thing in budding is actually the M1 thing, which actually forms the matrix protein, which actually forms the inside of the virus. These things accumulate at the surface of the cell and allow it to form a nice little bulb, which eventually breaks off, and here's my free virus moving away, ready to infect your other cell. This is where the action takes place. It's basically, I said, in the upper respiratory tract, so roughly all the way down to here is where you'd expect to see damage in a normal seasonal infection. And here's maybe how you can look at your lungs. Now, you'll notice that I've actually drawn a single layer of epithelial cells. This is mostly correct. There's kind of two layers in this area, two or three. But over here, as you go lower, basically your lung turns into this monolayer of cells. That's fantastic, because what you have is a two-dimensional system. So if you ever wanted to do an agent-based model, you're good to go. It's a cylinder, you cut it up, you unfold it, and you have periodic boundary condition, and it's actually physiologically correct. So that's pretty sweet, just for those of you who are agent-based inclined. So here are my cells, and they're different types of cells. Some of them are ciliated, some of them are not, and the virus attaches preferentially to some cells rather than other, depending on the viral strain, and mostly depending on whether the virus is human-adapted or animal-adapted, maybe bird-adapted, for example. And we'll attach to the cell and infect the cells in the way I described just before. And again, apical side, only from the top. And the green stuff here is your mucus, and that's the best way to clear the virus. Virus buds up cell, gets stuck in mucus, gets carried away, hopefully. All right, this is kind of a big picture time course of influenza over time in a single person. So these are days. Now, all the talks we've seen so far were HCV or HIV, and these went out to like 20 days or years. We're talking about by 8 days, there's basically nothing to speak of almost. Okay, so it's important to keep that in mind as we go through. Your viral titer will basically go up and down, peaking somewhere between day 2 or 3. By day 5 or 6, you're basically below detection level, and so there's at least no virus to speak of in terms of detection. This is what I was talking about, fairly massive death of cell. Now, this shape was actually completely made by me in a paint program, so this is by no means something real. But basically, I wanted to give you an idea of the level of cell destruction. And in fact, if you ever see histological pictures of the upper lung, what you see is completely bare basal membrane. There are no cells left to speak of. So it's fairly intense destruction. And when I say 30 to 50% dead, it means that the rest are actually cells that are, these are all cells next to each other. So there's large bare areas and then areas with cells. And it's kind of a freaky sight, actually. But one thing you want to see, and that's why I'm kind of not going to talk about the immune system, is this. Okay? So basically, the antibodies in CDL are first detectable here. That's also just about the time my virus is no longer detectable. Right? So if I'm basing a model on viral titer, including the immune system, doesn't make much sense, at least not the adaptive immune system. The CTL peaks somewhere around day 10, okay? I can make my point about that, and the antibodies around day 8. So you can see that the adaptive immune response has a fairly limited role to play, and that's also what's been thought of as being the problem with if we try to develop T-cell vaccines for influenza, which is basically that they show up so darn late that it's not really clear that they could really play a large role in the infection. Yes? This is a this is a secondary infection. Yeah. Yeah. So this is, there's been recent data, I think, on these, and I could pull out the reference if you need that. But this is even in a primary infection. Now, what there is during that time is an interferon gamma, alpha, and beta response. The alpha and beta basically display to regulate these adaptive immune responses. So again, we can kind of not think about them. But the interferon gamma, will play a somewhat important role, but I'm most likely going to neglect it. We'll see how that plays out. Then here's roughly the duration of your symptomatic infection. That's what we know. Here are things we would like to know: the rate of virus production and the fraction of productively infectious virions. So if you've got a whole bunch of virions and I can count their RNA, how many of them are infectious, how many of them are produced, the mechanism and rate of viral clearance, both in vivo and in vitro, understanding how these mechanisms work, and of course, a lot more. And these are all things we don't really know to this day. Here's one attempt at doing that. This was back in 2006, I believe. And basically what was done is there was a model built, an ODE model, to try and figure out if from viral titer from patients we can extract parameters. And most importantly, we were interested in getting the basic reproductive numbers, but also as many parameters as we possibly could. So we developed the ODE, the same story you usually see. There are a few challenges, of course, that different humans have different immune responses and different response to the pathogen, and that there are many factors that participate in the infection, but all we had is viral titer, so we have to neglect most of them. So here's the ODE. You've seen it millions of times. One thing I might point out is that there's no cell regeneration. Again, if we go back to the picture of influenza, you remember it lasts like 6 days. So cell regeneration is not a big issue. And even though cell regeneration might get underway before that, maybe around day 4 or something, the point is these cells have to fully differentiate and express sufficient number of receptors to actually be infectable again. So if they're not playing a role in the infection, even if they come back, I don't have to worry about them. So for the most part, I don't have cell regeneration in these models. And in fact, those of us who have tried to put cell regeneration, the model intentionally set it to 0. Right? If you do a fit, it just goes away. Now, that's also because we have way more parameters than data points most often. So unlike our lucky colleague from yesterday from Japan who had a lot of data, we typically, because if you take in vivo data, you have very little of it. And so usually we have more parameters than data points, which, as you know, is not a good thing. So a few things to point out. We're including the effect of the immune system through the parameters death and clearance. So you can imagine that the adaptive immune system, okay, we neglect. The innate immune response, you can kind of take care of from CN delta. You can think of it as maybe shortening the lifespan of infected cell, maybe preventing infection a little bit, maybe increasing clearance. So you can imagine that these parameters maybe can implicitly take into consideration at least some of these effects, but that requires the assumption that these effects are somewhat constant over time, which is not necessarily the case. But that's one trick you can play. Of course, the R0 is easy to obtain for that, and you guys probably seen that one before. We're assuming that, in fact, the infection stops. Given that there's no immune system, the infection stops when you've run out of cells. Now, that might seem a bit drastic because you're like, well, if I ran out of cells, I'm dead. No, you run out of the usually infected cells. So you just set the number of cell to the cells that usually get infected. You just redefine what T0 is, and you play along with that. And because if you've ever seen these histology pictures, you know this is true, this is probably a fair thing to do. And we're not explicitly considering the effect of cytokines, but as I say, they're kind of merged into the parameters. Here is the big thing. So the data is, of course, all over the place, and the fit is doing as good a job as it can of the all over the place data. You'll notice, of course, there's no error bar, which is, you know, heartbreaking, but what can we do? You can see that some of them do a fairly good job, some of them not so much. Is it the data that's bad? Is it our model that's bad? Well, we know our model's not great, but the data's not great either. So it'd be hard to blame somebody. We've got the simple model here and the Eclipse model, and what I haven't said is the difference between the two. In this case, an infected cell right away starts producing virus. In this other case, the cell first goes into what's called the Eclipse phase, or latently infected cell, just like you have latently infected people. And while it's in that class, it does not produce virus. It's only once it's actually made it into the infectious class that it starts producing virus. Okay? So you can check the difference in the two models. They're not very significant. In some cases, it's very similar. In some cases, it's a bit of a difference. But I also have to put a big disclaimer. This was done with a terrible, terrible parameter fitter. And so probably if we ran this again, we'd get slightly different parameters. And in fact, we did run them again, and we did get different parameters. But it's not extremely important for the purpose of this talk, unless you're going to go and use these parameters. Then you might want to talk to me. Okay, so basically, simple model, Eclipse model, they both do very well. Unfortunately, I've truncated the sum of square residual, which should have been the last column, but it's For my purposes, all I'm trying to tell you is that basically we've got here an R0 of about 11, about 22 in the case of the eclipse phase model. So clearly we don't get the same R0 depending on what model we use. Not a big deal. Total amount of time a cell stays infected for, 11 hours in the case of the model, 5.6 hours in the case of the other model. We think this one is biologically more correct, even though it's not actually supported by the very limited amount of data we have. But it still gives us some information. So for example, the interesting thing is we get an eclipse phase like 6 hours. We know the eclipse phase is the amount of time a cell spends not producing virus. It's roughly 4 to 6 hours. So that was, we're extremely happy with that, although the refits have actually changed that wonderful gain. So basically, what is the lesson here is that we have more parameters than we have data points. And so there's a fit. We're happy about it, but there's a lot of problems. One other thing I want to point out is the units of beta and P. Now, production rate and infectivity is something that would be interesting to get to. How many viruses does a cell produce? The problem is virus is actually measured in units of TCID 50 per milliliter of nasal wash. That means they take your nasal wash and they count the number of infectious viruses in there. Now, most of you are used to maybe HIV or HCV. Viruses counted by RNA counts or DNA counts, right? So it's actually number of protein of a certain type that's packed into the virus, so that's roughly the number of virus particles. It is not the number of infectious virus particles. So in influenza, we can actually count TCID 50, which stands for tissue culture infectious dose 50, is the amount of virus you have to give to infect half of your cell cultures. And I could explain more about that if you want at the break, but basically, this is the number of infectious virus over time, but it's still a weird unit. And it also means then that your production rate of virus is how much your cell produces of TCID 50 per milliliter nasal wash per day. Well, that's a ridiculous unit, and that's completely uninteresting. So unfortunately, because of the units of virus, beta and P are utterly uninteresting. What is not uninteresting is the clearance rate of the virus. So from that, you can figure out the half-life of the virus and the lifespan of the cells. These time-only dependent parameters are important. But here's another thing to consider. If you look at the clearance rate and the... Oh, I don't have one over where I can't compare them. Ah, damn it. Okay, so in the original paper, we have clearance rate and delta, so one over this. And what you actually see is in some cases, the parameters have the same value. Okay? And that's because we've discovered that the viral downslope, the decay rate of the virus, is actually the fastest of the clearance rate of the lifespan of the slowest of the lifespan of infected cell, or the slowest of delta or C. So the slowest of rate of loss of infected cell or rate of loss of virus. Whichever one decays the slowest dictates that downslope. And so, unless you know, it's one of the two takes the value, and the other one can be set to anything that is larger than the first. So that's something to keep in mind. So we also did a quick look in that paper at interferon. The way we added interferon is in two different ways. Interferon, and so we're considering interferon gamma. It could possibly inhibit cell infection, so the cell maybe will take in the virus and will get into the eclipse phase, but will never move on to the productively infectious state because of interferon's action. Another possibility is that interferon's actually modulating the viral release rate, the viral production rate, and so it would appear like this. And I'll have you know that this term is actually exactly like the 1 minus epsilon you've seen for the drugs so far, as long as you assume that the maximum effect of the drug is 1, and so then this var epsilon 2 and var epsilon 1 are actually the equivalent of 1 over the IC50 of the interferon. Does everybody know what IC50 is? Ha, okay. So IC50 is the drug concentration you need to put in to reduce, for example, viral titer by 50%. Okay, so how much drug, so if I have an infection, how much drug do I have to put in? What concentration of drug do I have to put in to have half the amount of virus produced? And so basically, we can get the IC50 of interferon that way. Okay, and then of course, the growth of interferon, we've set that to about half a day because we found that that worked well. But as you see, this is done very loosely. What we really wanted to know is, can our curve for viral titer actually reproduce the double peak that we see in some patients? And you see that we somewhat can, but the real question is are there really two peaks? And that's a good question because there are no error bars. So is that dip really statistically significant or not? And there's no way to know. But basically, interferon can lead to two peaks.
Woo!
Hooray. So basically, does that lead to different parameters? Yes, it does. So who knows what the correct parameter values are. So conclusion, this is awesome because we can fit data. We're not sure about the parameters, but we're able to extract some things that we think are somewhat relevant. The lifespan of a cell in vivo, about 11 hours. A basic reductive number of about 22. And a half-life for the virions in vivo of about 3.2 hours. This model was so much fun when it came out that Roche Pharmaceutical actually grabbed it and started running it on their thousands and thousands of patient database and are not publishing it, unfortunately. But I'm hoping to get my hands on that, and maybe we can talk about it later. So unfortunately, of course, the parameter estimates are severely weakened by the fact that we have more of them than we have data points. The experimental data was too limited to consider stuff like interferon or an adaptive immune response, and the unit of viral titer make it very unfortunate for us to get a relevant P or beta value. I want to talk about another project we did, doing okay on time, God. So this is in collaboration with a drug company that's trying to develop, they're trying to do something that is relevant to antiviral production. So basically, what's important here is that we actually just studied the effect of amantadine. So just a quick picture of the two main types of drugs against influenza. So this is the influenza reproduction replication cycle, kind of not by me. So this is the virus attaching to the cell, gets absorbed, RNA comes out, virus buds, and then off goes the virus. The amantadine blocks this kind of process, and the neuraminidase inhibitor, of which oseltamivir or Tamiflu is, blocks the release of the virus. So the cell actually gets infected, starts to produce virus, but the virus cannot cleave themselves from the cell and move on to infect another cell. The idea maintains roughly around 2005-2006, we realized that drug resistance was around 90%, and so the CDC says no more amantadine. So they stopped prescribing it after that. The neuraminidase inhibitors, at that time, in 05-06, there was a lot of check for resistance, and at that time it was around 0.4 to 1%, and people said, there's never going to be resistant to oseltamivir, there's no way. When we do see mutants, they're so not fit that they're immediately outcompeted by the wild type. This is not going to be a problem at all. And, here's where we're at now. Tamiflu not working so well for us. In the 08-09 season, which was the one just before the swine flu season, resistance was at 90%. And Ben is going to talk a little bit this afternoon about how this came about, I hope. Right, Ben? Yeah, sure. Okay, perfect. So basically, we're going to look at this drug now. And basically what we did is we actually built an ODE model, which is basically the same model I just showed you, and we pitted it against this little machine, which is an in vitro simulation of drug. So these are all computer-controlled syringe that can make sure you get exactly the drug kinetic you want, but really we used it in a very lame way, which is to make sure that the drug stays absolutely flat for the purpose of modeling. So basically, here's the hollow fiber bundle. So you put all your cells in there, and these little things have capillaries that actually release the drug and make sure it stays at equilibrium, and you run your infection inside these things. So we know how we start the infection. We start with 10 to the 8 MDCK cells, 100 pre-infected cells. They were infected with the A albumin H3N2, and you know how to read those now. And basically, we keep the amantadine concentration constant. Here's the model. Now, there's one thing I want to point out. So this is classic, blocking production by blocking infection. These are the two things, in this case, blocking infection. Now, one thing I should point out is that it doesn't appear in front of the beta, and that's because we believe that the virus, so it's actually, the cell becomes infected. So the virus goes into the cell, but cannot release its RNA, but obviously the virus on its way in has cleaved a bit of salic acid, and with each virus that comes in, a little bit of membrane is eaten up, and a little bit of salic acid is eaten up. So we're seeing this as these target cells becoming unavailable to infection over time, but not becoming infectious. So that's why this term only appears here. And in fact, we tried both having the term in both places and having the term just here, and having the term just here gave us a better fit. Hence, that's what I'm presenting. The other thing to point out is the gamma and C term here. This is for the clearance rate of virus. We're talking about in vitro. The virus has nowhere to go. So why is there a clearance rate? That's because we're counting infectious virus particles, and virus loses infectivity over time. So this is the rate at which virus will become non-infectious over time. And gamma is the rate at which I'm going to lose my virus because they're entering the cell. And it need not be equal to beta, right? I could lose 10 virus for each cell. The other thing is, these are not in number of virus, as you can imagine. It's, again, these weird units of PCID 50 per milliliter. So God knows how many of those are lost when you infect a cell. Okay. So the R-naught is slightly different. And this is how the drug, this is the Emax model. This is how the drug is included in the model. It's the drug concentration. This is the IC50 I just told you about. So as you see, when the drug concentration is exactly equal to the IC50, you get a 50% drug efficacy. Okay? So here's how we estimate clearance, because we have a few parameters here. But we can, because it's in vitro, we can calculate the rate at which we lose virus infectivity over time. So what you do is you get a beaker, you shove a whole bunch of virus in it, and you titrate the virus over time. And in case the drug actually has a toxic effect on the virus and contributes to its losing infectivity, we tried that at different amantadine concentration. And you see that there's no difference, so actually we grouped all the points together and did a fit and find that the half-life of the virus is about 6.6 hours, right? So in about 6.6 hours, you've lost about 50% of your infectious virus. So basically, if you're titrating away, infecting your well, you better do that quick, because by the time you get to the last well, you might not have as many viruses as you started with on the first well. That's just a lesson for those of you, and I'm sure that's none of you, who actually do experiments. Okay, so here's the data for different drug concentration, and here are three different fits. So we had three models, the simple, the eclipse, and the delay model. This is the model in which I put actually a hard delay rather than an exponential delay, just for the hell of checking how this works out. And here are the three fits. You can see they're somewhat comparable, at least visually. And you can see what happens is that the drug increases, the peak actually goes slightly down and shifts to the right. Now, that doesn't seem like a huge gain. Like, this is not a drug I want to take, right? But the point is, if you're helped with by your immune system, by your innate immune system, this can make a big difference. You're actually giving it time to ramp up by pushing the peak over, right? So here are the parameters, some of them anyways, the relevant one. You can see that from these I can extract the IC50, but what I want to draw, so we get an IC50 that's somewhere between 0.3 and 0.4 micromolar, and this is in good agreement, for example, with... For A. Panama, it's 0.56 micromolar. So we're doing pretty good in terms of estimating the IC50 from these experiments. The problem is this. The number of virus to infect one cell. So we actually felt that these PCID50 actually was number of infectious virus particles. And there's good reasons to believe that. And we say per milliliter, but we know how many milliliters we took out. So we really should be able to get to the number of infectious virus. And so my term over here, number of virus to infect one cell, is actually gamma over beta. Okay, so number of virus loss per number of cell loss to infection. And I would expect that number to be greater than 1. And it's not. So that was puzzling, because apparently it takes a third of a virus to infect a cell. That didn't seem right. The other thing is the number of virus produced per cell is about 2.8 to 3.4. Again, that seems really low. Maybe this is revolutionary, but it just felt wrong. And of course, my R-naught is actually 9.3. So apparently, I can infect, again, multiple cells with one virus, which is how I can get an R-naught of 9.3 and yet have a number of virus produced of 2.8. Clearly, something has gone terribly wrong. What is it? It's how you count the infectious virus. Now, for those of you who never knew how they count infectious virus, ha, here's your chance. This is how they count PFUs, plaque-forming units. What you do is you take a whole bunch of cells and you infect them with the virus at a low MOI, low multiplicity of infection, so few virions. And you want very few virions because each virion is going to form one plaque. And if you put too many, you can't count your plaque anymore because, believe it or not, they count it by hand. Click, click, click with a little clicker. Yeah, I'm not kidding. Okay, so here's the plaque. And what they do is they try different dilutions until it looks right. Just like that is pretty much what they want. But then the question is, okay, if I've got something like that and here's a zoom in of it, is that one plaque or is that like, should I count these specks? Like, what do I do with that? And what about the border? I seem to have lost viruses at the edge there. Should I do something about that? So there's that. There's also the fact that, so in order to get gamma over beta to be greater than 1, I actually need to assume that I'm losing about 90% of my virus. And that seemed a bit high, right? 90% of the virus are not counted. Like, what the hell are these guys doing? I bet I could do a better job. Well, it turns out what they do is they actually have a life. And so when they've collected the virus, they freeze it. And when they have time later, they go and thaw that sample and assay it this way. Well, the freeze-thaw cycle actually will kill approximately, as they say, 1 log of virus. And that corresponds to a 90% loss in virus. And so we're like, yes! So just by that freeze-thaw, we can get this 90% reduction in our number of virus. So we're feeling pretty good. It means that if you rescale your virus, and that's how you would rescale it, this is the real amount of virus you have, this is how much you counted, you can actually get, see, they show up nicely, that alpha shows up nicely, so you get the same R-naught, so it does not affect R-naught, which is sweet. So your viral units being screwed up does not affect your R-naught calculation, but it will affect, for example, how many virus are produced by a cell, or the beta to gamma, so how many infectious virus per cell. Okay? So basically, if we correct for that, we see that a cell maybe produced 10 to 33 virons over its lifespan, and that may very well be reasonable, because the error rate is very high for a viral mutation. I'm going to skip that, because I want to get to something more interesting. So then, once you've got to understand how your drug acts on your virus, next thing you can do is figure out what kind of resistance you're expecting to see. And we're going to have more talks about resistance later today, I think the last session, but I get to open up. So I'll talk to you about a little bit about the kind of issues that can come up. So again, you've seen this figure before, and so the amantadine blocks infection, neuraminidase inhibitor block release, and it's going to be important to keep track of this. But basically, this high level of resistance begs that we actually investigate how it comes about and whether we can make it go away, or whether we can design drugs that will not have this caveat. So what did we do? We developed a model for the treatment and the emergence of drug resistance. We need to quantify the specific fitness impairments of mutants, and that's what Ben's going to talk about this afternoon. And we have to use this information to predict the spread and severity of the resistance, which can then be plugged into epidemiological models that a lot of you are doing that can be now better informed by the in vivo aspect of the disease. Here's our model. We've got target cells, and they can either be infected by the wild-type virus or the mutant virus. And the drug, the amantadine, will act differently, of course, on the infection of the infection of wild-type virus by of cells by wild-type virus, then the mutant, the eclipse phase go into infected, and then there's production, and you'll see that what we allow is for the wild-type cells to produce wild-type, but also some amount of mutant viruses due to some mutation, and then the infected cells that are infected with the mutant strain will produce mutant virus predominantly, but also some amount of wild-type virus, because basically, as if you guys were there in the first session on Monday, first day of this meeting, not this one, the one 2 weeks ago, they talked, what's her name? Allison McGeer talked about drug resistance and the fact that a oseltamivir resistance comes about with a single amino acid mutation. Well, if you mutate one way, it seems easy enough to mutate back the other way. And in fact, the probability should be the same. And so in our model, forward and backward mutation is equal because it's a single amino acid change, so why not? And so that's why both mutants can produce wild type and wild type can produce mutant. And then there's the effect of the drug being, in this case, this is the effect of the oseltamivir, this is the effect of the amantadine. So we can turn one drug on, the other drug on. This is a model. It's a little messy, but it's basically this picture. Put in math. And again, we have that drug efficacy term, and this is our mutation rates for wild type to mutant and mutant to wild type. Here are little caveats. This is kind of my disclaimer about this model. We're going to only consider a single amino acid change. That's because most of the mutants we see have just that one mutation, and most of the time when we see drug resistance in a virus, in an H1N1 virus for oseltamivir, we see the H274Y mutant is the most common by far. I said in N2, it's H275Y in N1. And for amantadine, it's usually S31N mutant that you'll see most often. So we'll only interest ourselves in the S31N for amantadine resistance and the H274Y for oseltamivir resistance. We're going to assume that any mutation elsewhere does nothing at all. We're going to assume that the infectivity of the wild type is equal to the infectivity of the mutant, unless otherwise stated. That the production rate of virus and the production rate of mutant is the same, unless otherwise stated. Cells die at the same rate. Go from the latent to productively infectious state around the same time. And we're setting our drug like this. The efficacy of the amantadine and neuraminidase is around 92%. We're going to set it to that. And that for the mutant to about 0.005%. That's 0.5%. And that's based on, for example, if you look at oseltamivir drug-resistant mutants, you see that you've got 1 nanomolar for the IC50, 440 for the mutant, And so if you consider the wild type, the drug efficacy of the wild type to be 91.5%, you'd expect the drug efficacy of the mutant to be 0.02, not very far from 0.05 and 0.005, and it makes not a whole lot of difference if you change these numbers. Now, it is very realistic. They've basically, that is the freaky part, my friend. Okay, but Ben is going to talk a little bit more about this, but mostly the wild type and the mutants are equally fit, and that is scary. But we'll come back to fitness later. Okay, so here's why you don't use a continuous, non-discrete model to model this. This is what happened if you put drug treatment in the ODE, the unfooled around with ODE. What you get is if I do prophylactic treatment, meaning I start treating before the person gets infected. You know what that does? It means the person does not become infected. That's what it comes down to. There's a few breakthrough infections, but for the most part, if I treat you prophylactically with a drug, you will not get the infection. Here's what happens in our model. You just get the infection later. If that's all drugs did, they would not give them prophylactically. So we can see right there and then, if you've got a model for drug resistance and you test the prophylactic case and you get an infection, you can't use that model because there really should not be an infection, or at least in most cases there shouldn't be an infection. There's a few breakthroughs. So how did we fix this? So I'm just looking at one of our differential equations. What you do is you change it into a difference equation, and here is the dvdt term that I actually multiply now by delta t, and here's my little term for production rate of mutants and wild type and then the clearance of these viruses. So maybe this term corresponds to 12 and this whole term corresponds to 2.3. So what do? I have to have an integer number of virions, and so I take 14, which is 12 plus 2, plus I've got a 30% chance of actually adding an extra 1, so having 15 instead. That's how I'm simulating it. That's how I'm quantifying it. Okay? To be able to do that, you need to translate amount of virus in units of TCID 50 per milliliter to actual infectious virions. That's a problem. We have no idea how to do that. So we looked at what if you change the scaling. So this is a wrong thing. This is scaling. What if you change the scaling of one TCID 50 per milliliter to number of infectious virions? And how does that affect the number of breakthrough infections you're going to get based on drug efficacy? So we're actually still working on these. These are all work in progress. But basically, you can see that the fraction of breakthrough infections, so this is the critical drug efficacy. This is the efficacy at which R0 is 1. Okay, so you can see there's actually a transition between this state and that state. This is R0 less than 1. This is R0 above 1. And you can see this is a transition drug efficacy. Okay, so basically, at that efficacy or less, you're going to start having a lot of breakthrough infection, even with your stochastic model, with your discretized model. You're going to have a lot of breakthrough infections, even with prophylactic treatment. And that's true also for the neuraminidase inhibitors. You'll notice that in neuraminidase inhibitor, for the same drug efficacy, you get more breakthrough infection. And we'll come back to that in a bit. So here's the corrected model, the one that is actually stochastic. And you can see that in the case of a normal infection with no drug treatment, you still expect to see these mutants, but at a very low level because they're not selected for. So this is approximately a 4-log difference. See, I speak biologist now. Divided by 10,000, approximately 1 in 10,000 virions is a mutant. So this is, on this side is amantadine, on this side is neuraminidase inhibitor. And here are a few of our stochastic simulation, and 1 out of 10 in both cases here actually developed into a breakthrough infection. Okay, but this, don't quote this number, obviously, and we just did 10. We're going to need to do a lot more than that to give you statistics. I'm just saying right here, this is just one of the 10 simulations. Same here. Okay. We can also look at the time of dominance, which is at what time does the mutant overtake the wild-type population? Does it get above 50? And you can see this is obviously stochastic simulation, but you can see that the neuraminidase inhibitors, no matter the relative fitness, so this is where we play with fitness, right? So this is the mutant wild-type being at equal fitness. This is how they have different fitnesses. So this is the mutant being less fit and the mutant being more fit than the wild type. And both of those are possible, by the way. We've seen both varieties by now. But basically, you see that in all cases, the neuraminidase inhibitor, so basically oseltamivir, develops resistance before amantadine. And that's because of its mode of action. Amantadine blocks infection. No virus gets produced, no chance for mutation to occur. Neuraminidase inhibitor, like oseltamivir, blocks viral release, which means the cell becomes infected, produces virus, has a chance to develop a drug-resistant mutant, and that might break away. And once that dude breaks away, all hell breaks loose. And that's how you get a breakthrough infection. And this is why oseltamivir is more likely to cause resistance than neuraminidase inhibitor, than amantadine. And that's actually very counterintuitive. A lot of people thought amantadine was a crap drug because resistance emerged right away. Well, it didn't. It was over several years that we finally saw resistance. And in fact, with oseltamivir, they've not been on the market that long, and here we are with resistance. And here's the more important thing. We were talking about fitness. What you can do is you can take this model, and you can simulate, the model, and you can simulate an infection and see how many virions, what fraction of the virions I produce are mutant or wild type. Let's say I have 20% mutant. Okay, then I grab this and I infect a person with the same proportion of mutant to wild type when I infect them. And I keep feeding that back into the model. So what I'm doing is kind of sequential infection. I'm kind of infecting populations after population, assuming that the fitness is the same for the wild type and the mutant, right? And you can do this and keep feeding it back and see what is a stable ratio of wild type to mutant infections in the population if I play this game. What you see is that if they're equally fit, you'll have an equal amount of them. That's reassuring. That means this is working. Obviously, if they're equally fit, they'll be equal in equal proportions. What you see, though, is that horrible shape of that curve. A small misestimation in fitness caused a huge difference in how much mutants you expect to see. So this outlines the importance of actually knowing what the fitness difference between the wild type and the mutant is, because a tiny difference in fitness will cause a huge difference in how much I expect to see. At least over here. Once you're in this region, well, you know, it's not a big difference, right? But over here, and that's where most of our mutants live, that's where we have to worry about it. And that's why we have to get fitness right. The way people assess fitness is this way. They do these SPLAC assays, and I'm not going to talk about that because I think Ben is going to talk about it. I haven't seen his talk yet. But basically, this is my wild type. This is my S31N mutant I told you about, the drug resistant to amantadine. And you can see that the diameters of the plaque are actually somewhat bigger, not statistically significantly bigger, but you can see that these plaques are of similar size, meaning, at least as far as experimentalists will tell you, meaning that these two strains are approximately equally fit, which goes to answer your earlier question, right? So they do these things, and Ben will tell you why these things are not sufficient to assess fitness and how it can give very wrong results, I hope. Right, Ben? Oh, good. Okay. So what have we done? And I'm not going to talk about this too much. We've built in silico plaque assays. So you make your little agent-based model, and you run it off. And we've also got a PDE version of it for those of you who are ABM averse. And it works just the same way. We've verified that both models gave the same results, which is always very nice. But these ones give nice pictures. So we usually bring those to conferences. But you can see how nice it looks. Isn't it nice? Okay. But Ben's going to talk to you about this later. So I have a few minutes left, I think, to talk to you about some of the problems with the ODEs. Ben's going to talk to you more about them, but I want to talk to you a little bit about it. This is, again, the model. You'll recognize it. I've changed the eclipse phase from E to L for latent because I thought it was prettier. And we've got these decay rates, the rate at which the cell decays into the latent phase, and the rate at which we lose our infectious cell. So this is 1 over tau I is delta, 1 over tau L is K, if you're following along. But the assumption is the system is well mixed, which means that all virions see all cells, and vice versa. This is not necessarily true, and especially if you've got a plaque assay like I just showed you, it's obviously not true. Right? So if you want to model a system, you have to understand at what diffusion do I start having to worry about spatial effects. So we did. We actually calculated the effective beta, the infectivity parameter, as a function of time, as the infection progresses for different diffusion. If your diffusion is very large, you can see that beta is actually constant over time. And I think that's a comforting thought. These ODEs actually work at high diffusion. It's not surprising, but it's still nice to see that it works. It's constant. See, very pretty. Now, that's because you don't have many cells left. But basically, it's constant over time. That's beautiful. As you lower the diffusion, you see it starts dipping, and it dips more and more and more. So what you can do is you can use that slope to tell you at what diffusion can you no longer use the well-mixed assumption. And here it is. This is a slope as a function of diffusion. So for low diffusion, you get very plaque-like behavior. And as diffusion increases, eventually, your slope becomes flat or around zero. And that happens at these higher diffusion. Okay? And here's a picture. And this is awesome. This is a picture of the well. This is simulated. Picture of the well for each of these diffusion. So this is 10 to the minus 14. This is 10 to the minus 13. And you can see it's very plaque-like until about here and very well mixed over here. right at the interface around 10 to the minus 11, you get these kind of fractal plaque things, and they're kind of neat. But here's the important thing. If you take influenza, you put it in 37 degrees Celsius water, which is roughly the in vitro system, you actually get a diffusion of about 6 times 10 to minus 12 meters squared per second. That sits you right here on that plot, or right here in the picture. So we're not in vitro, if you've got this well, we're not exactly sitting in the well-mixed system. And so that's something you might want to take into consideration, and there's ways to estimate that diffusion based on that liquid. You can stain these particles, you can attach green fluorescent protein to those virions and make sure that this is well-mixed or not. There's other ways to do it, but basically, it's important to know that we're sitting right at the edge here. So it's important to take these things into consideration. What will it do? Well, if you mess up your diffusion coefficient estimate, you'll get a different curve for your viral titer. And since you're fitting your viral titer to your data, if you get the wrong diffusion, or in other words, if you assume the diffusion is small enough that you can use the ODE, you'll get different parameters than if you actually realize that it's not small enough to take the ODE, and you get that different curve. So it is important to know, because your parameter estimate will be completely wrong if you don't check. There's another assumption in these models, which is that these decay rates of latent to infected and infected to dead are exponentially distributed. That's not necessarily the case, and Ben will tell you all about this again. So basically, I've made it basically to the end. So it's important to keep in mind that the underlying assumptions of your model have to be correct, and you should keep track of what they are and whether they're correct for your system. And as Avanand said yesterday, go into no more detail than is required for your problem, but you might need these extra details sometimes. For the stuff I just talked to you about the building the in silico plaque assays, you can read this paper. I also want to point out that we have a whole flu day today, and this is almost done, so we can look forward to this part of the day. And then Andreas is going to tell us again about the balance between hemagglutinin, which allows the virus to attach to the cell, and neuraminidase, which allows it to break free. Too sticky is not good, you can't break free. Too loosey is not good, you can't infect. Right? So this is a very interesting problem. Venkata is going to talk to us about the CD4 T cells and how they can play a role in seasonal and the 2009 pandemic flu. Ben, if I haven't said his name enough, is going to tell us about the non-exponential delays in influenza and use the evidence from in vitro experiments for the nature of these delays. Hannah's going to talk to us about neuraminidase inhibitor treatment of seasonal and severe influenza, so we've developed some sort of model that allows us to get sustained viral titer versus not sustained viral titer, and we can test out treatment under these circumstances of simulated infections. Syed's going to talk to us about drug resistance some more. But he's probably going to talk about it a lot more than me because he's got half an hour to talk just about that. And Murray Alexander is going to talk to us about the control of flu by varying the death rates of infected cell. So I think we have a very fun flu day. I want to spend one more second to introduce you to Ben, who's sitting at the back, who's done a lot of the work I presented today. Hannah, who's also sitting at the back, who's done all of the drug resistance work. I just stole her slides right out of her previous talk. Philip, who has painstakingly counted all the plaques, and you'll see his picture again today, and Guy, who has forced him to do so. So I believe that's it. I'm ready to take questions.